Talk about lies meant much. So all Akos knew was from history class, as a kid, and rumor. Not that Thuvazit rumors about the Shotet had proved to be all that accurate. The Noavex hadn't been in power in Shotet before the Oracle spoke the fates of the family Noavek for the first time. Just 2 generations ago. When Lazmet's mother came of age, she had taken the throne by force, using her fate as justification for the coup. And later, when she had been sitting on the throne for at least 10 seasons, she had killed off all her siblings' children so her own would be guaranteed power. That was the kind of family Lazmet had come from. And he had been, by all accounts, every Izzet as brutal as his mother. "Oh, honestly," Tekka groaned. "Is it some kind of rule of the universe that at least one Noavek asshole has to be alive at any given time, or what?" Syra swiveled to face her. "What am I, then? Not alive?" "Not an asshole," Tekka replied. "Bicker with me much more and I'll change my mind." Syra looked faintly pleased. She wasn't used to people not considering her just another Noavek, Akos assumed. "Whatever the rules of the universe pertaining the Noaveks," she said, "I don't know how Lazmet is still alive, just that Rizek didn't appear to be lying when he told me. He wasn't trying to get anything in return. He was just warning me, maybe." Tekka snorted. "Because what? Rizek loves doing favors?" "Because he was scared of your dad," Akos said. When Syra did talk about Rizek, she always talked about how afraid he was. What could scare a man like Rizek more than the man who had made him the way he was? "Right? He's more terrified than anyone. Or he was, anyway." Syra nodded. "If Lazmet is alive," her eyes fluttered closed, "that needs to be corrected as soon as possible." That needs to be corrected. Like a math problem or a technical error. Akos didn't know how you could talk about your own dad that way. It rattled him more than it would have if Syra had seemed scared. She couldn't even talk about him like he was a person. What had she seen him do to make her talk about him that way? "One problem at a time," Tekka said, a little more gently than usual. Akos cleared his throat. "Yeah. First, let's survive getting through Agra's atmosphere. Then we can assassinate the most powerful man in Shotet history." Syra opened her eyes and laughed. "Settle in for the long ride," Tekka says. "We're bound for Agra."
Chapter 5. Sizi. The escape pod is only just big enough for the two of us pressed together. As it is, my shoulder is still jammed up against the glass wall. I fumble on the little control panel for the switch that activates the distress signal. It's lit up pink, and it's one of only 3 switches in front of me, so it's not hard to find. I flip it up and hear a high-pitched whistling, which means the signal is transmitting, Tekka said. Now all that's left to do is wait for Issei to wake up, and try not to panic. Being on a little transport vessel like the one we just left is nerve-wracking enough for a Hesse girl who's only left the planet a couple times, but the escape pod is another thing. It's more window than floor, the clear glass curving up over my head and all the way down to my toes. I don't feel like I'm looking out at space, so much as getting swallowed by it. I can't think about it, or I'll panic. I hope Issei wakes up soon. She's limp on the bench seat next to me, and her body is framed by a blackness so complete, she really does look like the only thing in the entire universe. I've known her only a couple years, since Ori disappeared to take care of her after her face got cut with a Shotet knife. She grew up far away from Thuva, on a transporter ship that took goods from one end of the galaxy to the other, whatever they could haul. It was a good thing Ori had been around to force us to talk to each other in the beginning. I might never have talked to her otherwise. She was intimidating even without the title. Tall and slim and beautiful. Scars or no scars. And radiating capability like a machine. I don't know how long it takes for her eyes to open. She drifts for a while, staring all bleary at what's in front of us, which is flat nothing in between the far-off wink of stars. Then she blinks at me. "See?" she says. "Where are we?" "We're in an escape pod, waiting for the assembly to come get us," I say. "An escape pod?" She frowns. "What did we need to escape from?" "I think it's more that they wanted to escape from us," I say. "Did you drug me?" She rubs her eyes with a fist, first the left one, and then the right. "You gave me that tea." "I didn't know there was anything in it." I'm a good liar, and I don't think twice. She wouldn't accept the truth, that I wanted to get her away from the rest of my family just as much as Akos did. Mom said Issei was going to try to kill Aija the same way she did Rizek, and I wasn't willing to risk it. I don't want to lose Aija again, no matter how warped he is now. "Mom warned them you might try to hurt Aija too." Issei curses. "Oracles. It's a wonder we even let them have citizenship, with all the loyalty her mother shows her own chancellor." I have nothing to say to that. She's frustrating, but she's my mother. I continue. "They put you in the pod, and I told them I was going with you." The scars that cross her face stay stiff while her brow furrows. She rubs them sometimes when she thinks no one is looking. She says it helps the scar tissue to stretch out, so one day she'll be able to move those parts of her face again. That's what the doctor said anyway. I once asked her why she just let the scars form instead of getting reconstructive surgery on Othir. It's not like she didn't have the resources. She told me she didn't want to get rid of them, that she liked them. "Why?" she finally says after a long pause. "They're your family. Aija's your brother. Why would you come with me?" Giving an honest answer isn't as easy as people say. There are so many answers to her question, all of them true. She's my chancellor, and I'm not going to oppose Thuva like my brother is. I care about her, as a friend, as whatever else we are to each other. I'm worried about the wild grief I saw in her right before she killed Rizek Noavec. And she needs help to do what's right from now on, rather than what satisfies her thirst for revenge. The list goes on, and the answer I choose is as much about what I want her to hear as it is about the truth. "You asked me if you could trust me," I finally say. "Well, you can. I'm with you, no matter what. Okay?" I thought, after what you saw me do, I think of the knife she used to kill Rizek dropping to the floor and push the memory away. I thought you wouldn't want to be anywhere near me. What she did to Rizek didn't disgust me. It worried me. I don't care that he's dead, but I do care that she was able to kill him. I don't try to explain that to her, though. "He killed Ori," I say. "So did your brother," she whispers. "It was both of them, Cece. There's something wrong with Aija. I saw it in Rizek's head right before..." She chokes before she can finish her sentence. "I know." I grab her hand and hold on tight. "I know." She starts to cry. At first, it's dignified, but then the beast of grief takes over, and she claws at my arms to get away from it, sobbing. But I know as well as anybody that there's no escape. Grief is absolute. I got you, I say, rubbing circles on her back. I got you. She stops scratching after a while, stops sobbing, just leans her face into my shoulder. What did you do? She asks, voice muffled by my shirt. After your dad died, after your brothers, I just did things for a long time. I ate, showered, worked, studied. But I wasn't really there, or at least I didn't feel like I was. But it was like when feeling comes back to a limb that's gone numb. It comes back in little prickles, little pieces at a time. She lifts her head to look at me. I'm sorry I didn't tell you what I was about to do. I'm sorry I asked you to come see that, she says. I needed a witness, just in case it went wrong, and you were the only one I trusted. I sigh and push her hair behind her ears. I know. Would you have stopped me, if you knew? I purse my lips. The real answer is that I don't know. But that's not the one I want to give her, not the one that will make her trust me. And she has to trust me, if I'm going to do any good in the war that's coming. No, I say. I know you only do what you have to. It was true, but it didn't mean I wasn't worried about how simple it had been to her. And the distant look in her eyes as she led me to that storage room, and the perfect hesitation she had shown Rizek as she waited for just the right moment to stab him. They're not going to take our planet, she says to me in a dark whisper. I won't let them. Good, I say. She takes my hand. We've held hands before, but that doesn't mean it doesn't still send a thrill through me when her skin slides over mine. She is still so capable, smooth and strong. I want to kiss her, but this isn't the time, not when there's still Rizek's blood drying under her fingernails. So I just let the touch of her hand be enough, and we stare out together at nothingness.
Chapter 6. Akos. Akos fumbled with the chain around his neck. The ring of Jorek and Ara's family was a now familiar weight right in the hollow of his throat. When he wore armor, it made an imprint in his skin, like a brand. As if the mark on his arm wasn't enough to remind him of what he had done to Suzau Kuzar, Jorek's father, and Ara's violent husband. He wasn't sure why he thought of killing Suzau in the arena now, standing outside his brother's cell. It was time to decide if Aija ought to stay drugged. For how long? Until they got to Agra? After that? Or if, now that Rizek was dead, it was safe to risk Aija wandering around the ship clear-headed? Syra and Tekka had left the decision up to him and his mom. His mom was right next to him, her head reaching just a few izzets higher than his shoulder. Hair loose and messy around her shoulders, curled into knots. Sifa hadn't been much of anywhere since Rizek died, holing up in the belly of the ship to whisper the future to herself, barefoot, pacing. Syra and Tekka had been alarmed, but he told them that's just how oracles were. Or at least, that was how his mother, the oracle, was. Sometimes sharp as a knife, sometimes half outside her own body, her own time. I just not how you remember him, he said to her. It was a useless warning. She knew it already, for one thing, and for another, She had probably seen him just the way he was now, and 100 other ways besides. "Still, I know," was all she said. Akos tapped the door with his knuckles, and then unlocked it with the key Tekka had given him, and walked in. I just sat cross-legged on the thin mattress they had thrown into the corner of the cell. An empty tray next to him with the dregs of soup left in a bowl on top of it. When he saw them, he scrambled to his feet, hands held out like he might put them in fists and start pummeling. He was wan and red-eyed and shaky. "What happened?" he said, eyes skirting Akos's. "I felt something. What happened?" "Rizek was killed," Akos replied. "You felt that? Did you do it?" Aija asked with a sneer. "Wouldn't be surprised. You killed Suzao. You killed Kalmev. And Voss," Akos said. "You've got Voss somewhere in that memory stew, don't you?" "He was a friend," Aija said. "He was the man who killed our father," Akos spat. Aija squinted and said nothing. "What about me?" Sifa said, voice flat. "Do you remember me, Aija?" He looked at her like he had only just noticed she was there. "You're Sifa," he frowned. "You're Mom. I don't... There's gaps." He stepped toward her and said, "Did I love you?" Akos had never seen Sifa look hurt before. Not even when they were younger and told her they hated her because she wouldn't let them go out with friends, or scolded them for bad scores on tests. He knew she got hurt, because she was a person as well as an oracle, and all people got hurt sometimes. But he wasn't quite ready for how the look pierced him when it came, the furrowed brow and downturned mouth. "Did I love you?" Akos knew, hearing those words, that he had definitely failed. He hadn't gotten Aija out of Shotet, as he had promised his father before he died. This wasn't really Aija, and what might have restored him was gone now that Rizek was dead. Aija was gone. Akos' throat got tight. "Only you can know," Sifa said. "Do you love me now?" Aija twitched, made an aborted hand gesture. Maybe. Sifa nodded. "Okay. You knew, didn't you, that I was the next oracle?" he said. "You knew I would be kidnapped. You didn't warn me. You didn't get me ready." "There are reasons for that," she said. "I doubt you would find any of them comforting." "Comfort," I just snorted. "I have no need for comfort." He sounded like Rizek then. That Shotet diction put into Thuvazit. "But you do," Sifa said. "Everybody does." Another snort, but no answer. "Come here to drug me again, did you?" he nodded to Akos. "That's what you're good for, right? You're a poison maker, and Syra's whore." Then Akos's hands were in fists in Aija's worn shirt, lifting him up so his toes were just brushing the floor. He was heavy, but not too heavy for Akos with the energy that burned inside him. energy that had nothing to do with the current. Akko slammed him into the wall and growled, "Shut your mouth." "Stop, both of you," Sifa said, her hand on Akko's shoulder. "Put him down, now. If you can't stay calm, you'll have to leave." Akko dropped Aija and stepped back. His ears were ringing. He hadn't meant to do that. Aija slid to the floor and ran his hands over his buzzed head. "I am not sure what Rizek Noavec dumping his memories into your skull has to do with being so cruel to your brother," Sifa said to Aija. "Unless it's just the only way you know how to be now. But I suggest you learn another way, and quickly, or I will devise a very creative punishment for you, as your mother and your superior, the sitting oracle. Understand?" Aija looked her over for a few ticks, then his chin shifted up and down just a little. "We are going to land in a few days," Sifa said. "We will keep you locked in here until our descent, at which point we will ensure you are safely strapped in with the rest of us. When we land, you will be my charge. You will do as I say. If you don't, I will have Akko drug you again. Our situation is too tenuous to risk you wreaking havoc." She turned to Akko. "How does that plan sound to you?" "Fine," he said, teeth gritted. "Good." She forced a smile that was completely without feeling. "Would you like anything to read while you're in here, Aija? Something to pass the time?" "Okay," Aija said with a half shrug. "I'll see what I can find." She stepped toward him, making Akko tense up in case she needed his help. But Aija didn't stir as she picked up his empty tray, and he didn't look up at either of them as they left the room. Akko locked it behind him and checked the handle twice to make sure the lock held. He was breathing fast. That was the Aija he remembered from Shotet, the one who walked around with Vas Kuzar like they were born friends instead of born enemies, and the one who held him down while Vas forced Syra to torture him. His eyes burned. He shut them. "Had you seen him that way?" he said. "In visions, I mean." "Yes," Sifa said, quiet. "Did it help? To know it was coming?" "It's not as straightforward as you think," she said. "I see so many paths, so many versions of people. I'm always surprised to discover which future has come to pass. I'm still not sure which Akko I'm speaking to, for example. There are many that you could be." She lapsed into quiet and sighed. "No," she said finally. "It didn't help." He gulped and opened his eyes, not looking at his mother, but at the wall opposite him. "I'm sorry I couldn't stop it. I failed him. Akko." She gripped his shoulder, and he let himself feel the warmth and the strength of her hand for a tick. The cell that had held Rizek was scrubbed clean, like nothing had ever happened. In some secret part of himself, he wished Aija had died too. It would be easier than this, the constant reminder of how he'd messed it all up and couldn't fix it. "There's nothing you..." "Don't," he said, more harshly than he meant to. "He's gone, and now there's nothing left to do but bear it." He turned and left her standing there, caught between two suns who weren't quite the same as they used to be. They took turns sitting on the nav deck to make sure the ship didn't steer straight into an asteroid or another spaceship or some other piece of debris. Sifa had the first shift, since Tekka was exhausted from reprogramming the ship in the first place, and Syra had spent the last several hours mopping up her own brother's blood. Akos cleared the floor of the galley and rolled out a blanket in the corner, near the medical supplies. Syra came to join him, her face scrubbed shiny and her hair in a braid over one shoulder. She lay shoulder to shoulder with him, and for a time neither of them said anything at all, just breathed in time together. It reminded him of being in her quarters on the Sojourn ship, how he could always hear when she was up because the tossing and turning stopped, and all he could hear were her breaths. "I'm glad he's dead," Syra said. He turned to face her, propping himself up on one elbow. She had trimmed the hair neatly around the silver skin. He'd gotten used to it now, shining on one side of her head like a mirror. It suited her, really, even if he hated what had happened to her. Her jaw was set. She started on the straps of the armor that covered her arm, working them back and forth until they were loose. When she shucked it, there was a new cut on her arm, right near her elbow, with a hash through it. He touched it lightly with a fingertip. "You didn't kill him," he said to her. "I know," she said. "But the Chancellor isn't going to take note of him, and," she sighed, "I guess I could have gotten some revenge from beyond death if I had let him go unmarked, dishonored him by pretending he never existed." "But you couldn't do that," Akos supplied. "I couldn't," Syra agreed. "He's still my brother. His life is still notable. And you're upset that you couldn't punish him. Sort of. Well, if my opinion counts for anything, I don't think you need to regret showing some mercy," he said. "I'm just sorry you went to all the trouble of sparing him from me, and then it didn't even matter." With a heavy sigh, he slumped to the ground again, just another way that he'd failed. She laid a hand on him right over his sternum, right over his heart, with the scarred arm that said so much and so little about her at once. "I'm not," she said. "Sorry, I mean." "Well," he covered her hand with one of his own, "I'm not sorry you've got Rizek's loss marked on your arm, even though I hated him." The corners of her mouth twitched up. He was surprised to find that she had chipped off a little piece of his guilt, and he wondered if he'd done the same for her, in his way. They were both people who carried every scrap of everything around, but maybe they could help each other set things down, piece by piece. It was good he felt this way, he thought. With Aija gone, all that he had left to do was meet his fate. And Syra and his fate were inextricable. He would die for the family Noavek, and she was the last of them. She was a happy inevitability, brilliant and unavoidable. Acting on impulse, Akos turned and kissed her. She stuck her fingers in one of his belt loops and pulled him tight against her, the way they had been earlier when they were interrupted. But the door was closed now, and Tekka was fast asleep in some other part of the ship. They were alone, finally. The chemical floral smell of the ship was replaced with the smell of her, of the herbal shampoo she'd last used in the ship's shower, and sweat and sendus leaf. He ran potion-stained fingertips down the side of her throat and across the faint curve of her collarbone. She pushed him over so she was straddling him, and pinned his hips down for a tick, just to tug his shirt out from under his waistband. Her hands were so warm against him he could hardly breathe. They found the soft give of flesh around his middle, the taut muscle wrapped around his ribs. She undid buttons all the way up to his throat. He'd thought of this when he helped her take her clothes off before that bath in the Renegade safe house, how it might be to take off their clothes when they weren't injured and fighting for their lives. He'd imagined something frantic, but she was taking her time, running her fingers over the bumps of his ribs, the tendons on the inside of his wrists as she freed the buttons on his cuffs, the bones that stuck out of his shoulders. When he tried to touch her back, she pressed him away. That wasn't how she wanted it just then, it seemed like, and he was happy to give her what she wanted. She was the girl who couldn't touch people, after all. It sparked something inside him to know that he was the only one she'd done this with. Not excitement, but something softer, tender. She was his only, and fate said she would be his last. She pulled back to look at him, and he tugged at the hem of her shirt. "May I?" he said. She nodded. He felt suddenly tentative as he started undoing her shirt buttons from throat to waist. He sat up just enough to kiss the skin he revealed, izzet by izzet. Soft skin for someone so strong. Soft over hard muscle and bone and steely nerve. He tipped them over so he was leaning over her, leaving just enough space between them to feel her warmth without touching her. He stripped his shirt from his shoulders and kissed her stomach again. He'd run out of shirt to unbutton. He touched his nose to the inside of her hip and looked up at her. "Yes?" he said. "Yes," she said roughly. His hands closed over her waistband, and he ran parted lips over the skin he exposed, izzet by izzet.
Chapter 7. Sizi. The assembly ship is the size of a small planet, wide and round as a floater, but so much bigger it's downright alarming. It fills the windows of the little patrol ship that picked up our escape pod, made of glass and smooth, pale metal. "You've never seen it before?" Issa asks me. "Only images," I say. Its clear glass panels reflect the current stream where it burns pink, and emptiness where it doesn't. Little red lights along the ship's borders blink on and off like inhales and exhales. Its movements around the sun are so slight, it looks still. "It's different in images," I say, "much less impressive." "I spent 3 seasons here as a child." Issei's knuckles skim the glass. "Learning how to be proper. I had that brim accent. They didn't like that." I smile. "You still do, sometimes, when you forget to care. I like it." "You like it because the brim accent is so much like your Hessen one." She pokes her fingertip into my dimple, and I smack it away. "Come on," she says. "Time to dock." The ship's captain, a squat little man with sweat dotting his forehead, noses his little ship toward the massive assembly one. "To secure entrance B," I'd heard him say. The letter was painted above the doors, reflective. 2 metal panels pull apart under the B, and an enclosed walkway reaches for our ship's hatch. Hatch and walkway lock together with a hiss. Another crew member seals the connection with the pull of a lever. We all stand by the hatch doors as they open, making way for Issei to stand at the fore. It's a skeleton patrol crew that picked us up, meant to cruise around the middle band of the solar system in case someone's in trouble. Or making it. There's just a captain, a first officer, and 2 others on board with us, and they don't talk much. Likely because their Otherian isn't strong. They sound like Trellans to me when they do speak. I skip ahead into the bright tunnel beyond the hatch doors to catch up to Issei. The glass walls are so clean. I feel like I'm floating in nothingness for a tick, but the floor holds firm. I just make it to Issei's side when a group of official-looking people in pale gray uniforms greets us. At their sides are non-lethal channeling rods, designed to stun, not kill. The sight is reassuring. This is how things should be. Controlled, but not dangerous. The one in front, with a row of medals on his chest, bows to Issei.
"Hello, Chancellor," he says in crisp Otherian. "I am Captain Morrell. The Assembly Leader has been informed of your arrival, and your quarters have been prepared, as well as those of your guest."
Issei smooths her sweater down, like that's going to get the folds out of it. "Thank you, Captain Morrell," she says, all traces of brim accent gone. "May I introduce CZ Karaseth, a family friend from the nation planet of Thuva?"
"A pleasure," Captain Morrell says to me.
I let my gift unfold right away. It's just instinct at this point. Most people react well when I think of my current gift as a blanket falling over their shoulders, and Captain Morrell is no exception. He relaxes right in front of me, and his smile softens, like he actually means it. I think it works on Issei, too, for the first time in days. She looks a little softer around the eyes. "Captain Morrell," I say, "thank you for the welcome."
"Allow me to escort you to your quarters," he says. "Thank you for delivering Chancellor Benazit safely here, sir," he adds to the captain who brought us here.
The man grunts a little and nods at Issei and me as we turn to go. Captain Morrell's shoes snap when he walks, and when he turns corners, they slide a little as the balls of his feet twist into the floor. If he's here, it's because he was born into a rich family on whatever his home planet is, but doesn't have the disposition, or the stomach, for actual military service. He's just right for tasks like these, which require manners and diplomacy and polish. When the captain delivers me to my room, right next to Issei's, for convenience, I sigh with relief. After the door shuts behind me, I let my jacket slide off my shoulders and fall to my feet. The rooms have been set for us, clearly. That's the only explanation for the field of feathergrass twitching in the wind on the far wall. It's footage of Thuva. Right in front of it is a narrow bed with a thick brown blanket tucked around the mattress. I put a hand on the touch panel near the door, flicking images and text forward until I find the one I want. Wall footage. I scroll until I find one of Hessa in the snow. The top of the hill sparkles red from the domed roof of the temple. I follow the bumps of house roofs all the way to the bottom of the hill, watching weather vanes spin as I do. All the buildings are hidden behind a white haze of snowflakes. Sometimes I forget how beautiful my home is. I see just the corner of the fields my dad farmed, and the image cuts off. Somewhere past them is the empty spot where we held Ija's and Akos's funerals. It wasn't my idea. Mom was the one who stacked the wood and burn stones, who said the prayer and lit it up. I just stood close by in my kutya coat, the face shield on so I could cry without anyone seeing. I hadn't thought of Ija and Akos as lost, truly lost, until then. If Mom was burning the pyres, I thought, that must mean she knew they were dead, in the way only an oracle could know things. But she hadn't known nearly as much as I thought. I fall to the bed and stare up at the snow. Maybe it wasn't smart to come here, to contend with a chancellor instead of following my own family. I don't know much about politics or government. I'm Hessa-born, so far out of my realm of knowledge it's almost funny. But I know Thuva. I know people. and someone needs to look out for Issei before she loses herself in grief. Issei's wall just looks like a window to space. Stars all glinting, little pricks of light, and the bend and swell of the current stream. It reminds me of a fight we had early on, before I knew her better. "You know nothing about my planet and its people," I said to her then. It was after she had gone public as chancellor. She and Ori had shown up at my apartment at school, and she had been rude to me for being so familiar with her sister. And for some reason, my current gift had let me be rude back. "This is only your first season on its soil." The broken look she gave me then is a lot like the one she's giving me now, as I walk into her quarters, twice the size of the ones given to me, but that's not surprising. She sits on the end of her bed in an undershirt and underwear that's really just a pair of shorts clinging to her long, skinny legs. It's more casual than I've ever seen her before, and more vulnerable, somehow, like letting me see her right after waking ripped her open somehow. "All my life I have loved this planet, more fervently than my family or my friends or even myself," she had replied back then. "You have walked all your seasons on its skin, but I have buried myself deep in its guts, so don't you dare tell me that I don't know it." The thing about Issei is, her outer shell is so thick I don't always believe there's something under it. She's not like Syra Novak, who lets you see everything writhing just out of reach, or like Akos, whose emotions glitter in his eyes like precious metal caught in the bottom of a pan. Issei is just blank. "My friend, the one I told you about, will be here soon," she says, her voice rough. "He wasn't far from here when I called." She'd commandeered the nav deck for a while when the patrol ship first picked us up, saying she needed to make a call to an old friend, one she grew up with. Ast was his name. She said she could use someone's help, someone who wasn't tied to the Assembly or Thuva or Shotet. Ast was Brimspawn, as some people like to call it, born out on some broken moon beyond the current stream barrier. "I'm glad," I say. I try one of my favorite feelings on her now, to calm her. Water, which is odd, since I don't know much about water, having grown up on an ice planet. But there was a hot spring in the basement of the temple in Hessa, to enhance the visions of the Oracle, and Mom had taken me there once to learn to tread water. It was dark as a tomb down there, but the hot water had surrounded me, all soft, like silk, only heavier. I let that heavy silk fold around Issei now, watch that tension in her shoulders ebb away. I'm learning her, slowly, and it's easier now that we're not on that little Shotet ship anymore. "He was the mechanic's son, on the ship where I was raised," she says, rubbing her eyes with the back of a hand. Her trade vessel was always adrift, never staying anywhere for long. The perfect place for someone who needed to stay hidden. "He was there, too, during the attack. He lost his father. Some of his friends, too." "What does he do now? Still a mechanic?" "Yeah," she says. "He was just finishing up a job on a fueling station near here, though. Good timing." Maybe it's the idea that she needs somebody else, even though I'm here. Or maybe it's just plain jealousy. But I don't feel good about Ast, and I don't know what he'll make of me. It's like thinking about him summons him, because the door buzzes right then. When Issei opens it, there's an Assembly type standing right there, his eyes sliding down her bare legs. Behind him is a broad-shouldered man holding two big canvas bags. He puts the side of his hand against the Assembly man's shoulder, and what looks like a flying beetle whizzes out of his sleeve. "Pazha!" Issei exclaims as the beetle lands on her outstretched hand. It's not a real bug. It's made of metal and emits a constant clicking. It's a guide bot, meant to help the blind maneuver. Ast tilts his head toward it, following the sound, and drops his bags just inside the doorway. Issei, with the beetle perched on her knuckles, throws her arms around him. Her current gift is tied to memory. She can't take a person's memories the way Rizek could, but she can see their memories. Sometimes she sees them even when she doesn't want to. So I understand when she tucks her nose into his shoulder, taking a sniff of him. She told me once that because smells are so tied to memory, they're special to her. They turn the tide of memory she sees when she touches somebody into a little trickle. Controlled, for once. It's not until Ast blinks that I notice his eyes. His irises are ringed with pale green light, and his pupils are circled with white. They're mechanical implants. They only move by shifting, incremental. I know they likely don't show him much, enough to help him, maybe, but they're just supplements, like the beetle Issei called Pazha. Nice new tech, Issei says to him.
Yeah, they're the new fashion in Othir,
he drawls in a brim lilt.
Everybody who's anybody is cutting out their eyes with butter knives and replacing them with tech.
Always with the sarcasm, Issei says. Do they actually help?
Some. Depends on the light. Ast shrugs. Seems like a nice setup in here.
He flicks his fingers, sending Pazha away from Issei's fist and into the room. It flies the perimeter of the room, whistling at each corner.
Big. Smells clean. Surprised you're not wearing a crown, Chancellor.
Didn't go with my outfit, Issei says. Come on, meet my friend, Sizi. The beetle is whizzing toward me now, turning fast circles around my head, shoulders, stomach, legs. I tried to hear the clicking like he does, how it reveals the shape and size of me to him, but my ears aren't trained for it. He's dressed in so many layers, I don't know what piece of clothing is what. Does the hood belong to his jacket, or the sweatshirt under it? How many t-shirts is he wearing? Two or three? There's a screwdriver at his hip, where a knife ought to be.
Ast, he says to me in almost a grunt.
He holds out his hand, waiting for me to step forward and take it. And I do. Sizi, I say. His skin is warm, and he has a good grip, not too tight. By instinct, I pick a current gift feeling for him. Waves of warmth, like ripples in the air. Most of my textures work for people who aren't in some kind of turmoil, at least a little. But the ones I like to use are the ones people don't detect. But judging by his little frown, he knows something isn't right.
Whoa. He says to me, what's that all about?
Oh, sorry, I say. My current gift is hard for me to control. I always lie about that. Makes people less wary. Sizi is the daughter of the Oracle of Thuva, Issei says. Sitting Oracle, I correct automatically.
There are different kinds?
Ast shrugs.
Didn't know that. We don't have oracles out there in the brim. Or faded nobility.
Faded families aren't nobility on Thuva, I say. Just unlucky.
Unlucky? Ast raises his eyebrows. I take it your fate doesn't meet with your approval?
No, it doesn't, I say softly. He fusses at his lower lip. One of his fingernails is so bruised it looks painted.
Sorry, he says after a beat. Didn't mean to touch on a sore subject.
It's fine. It's not true, and I get the sense we both know that, but he doesn't press me. Issei searches out her gown from the floor and pulls it over her shoulders, fastening it in front so the skirt is closed, though she doesn't bother with a dozen or so buttons that go up over her undershirt. You might have guessed that I didn't ask you here to bring me my old stuff, Issei says, folding her hands in front of her. She's switching into her formal speech, her chancellor posture. I can tell Ast notices something different. He
He looks almost alarmed, his eyes twitching from side to side. I want to ask for your assistance, for a longer period, she says. I don't know what you're doing, what you're leaving behind, but there aren't many people left I can trust. Maybe just the people in this room, and... He puts up a hand to stop her.
Quit it, he says. Of course I'll stay, as long as you need.
Really? He holds out his hand, and when she takes it, he shifts their grip, grasping her at the thumb, the way soldiers do. He brings their joined hands to his heart, like he's swearing an oath. But Brimspawn don't swear oaths, except by spitting, rumor has it.
I'm sorry about your sister, he says. I only met her once, I know. But I liked her.
It's beautiful, in its way. Straightforward and honest. I can tell why she likes him. I try another feeling, for him. An embrace of arms locked around the chest. Firm, but bracing.
Now that's downright disconcerting, Cece, he says. No way to turn it off?
My brother's current gift can, but I've never found anything else that does. I say, I've never met someone so aware of my gift before. I would ask him what his is, if that wasn't so impolite. Don't get so twitchy about it, Ast, Issei says. Cece's been helping me a lot.
Well, good.
He manages a small smile in my direction.
Issei's opinion about a person says a lot to me.
It says a lot to me, too, I say. I've heard a lot of stories about the ship you two grew up on.
She probably told you it smelled like feet, he says.
She did, I say, but she also said it was charming, in its way. Issei reaches for my hand, sliding her fingers between mine. It's the three of us against the galaxy now, she says. Hope you're both ready.
Don't be so dramatic, Ast says.
She purses her lips, tightens her hand on mine, and says quietly, I'm not. Chapter 8 Cece. Every now and then it hits me that most people don't make friends wherever they go. I do. Assembly headquarters is like anywhere else. People just want to be heard, even if what they have to say is boring.
And boy, is it boring most of the time.
I get good information from it sometimes, though. The woman behind me in the cafeteria line that morning, piling synthetic eggs high on her plate and covering them with some kind of green sauce, tells me there's a greenhouse on the second level stocked with plants from all over the solar system, a different room for each planet. I inhale a bowl of cooked grains and head there as soon as I can. It's been such a long time since I saw a plant. That's how I end up in the hallway just outside the room for Thuva. The corners of the windows are dusted with frost. I would need to put on protective gear to go in, so I stay just outside, crouched near the cluster of jealousies growing by the door. They're yellow and teardrop-shaped, but if you touch one at just the right time in its growth, it spits out a cloud of bright dust. Judging by the swollen bellies of these, they're just about ready to burst.
You know, try as we might, we can't seem to grow hush flowers here,
a voice says from behind me. The man is old, deep lines frame his eyes and mouth, and bald, the top of his head shiny. He wears pale gray slacks, like all the assembly staff do, and a thin gray sweater. His skin, too, looks almost pale gray, like he got caught downwind of the wrong field on Zold. If I think hard enough about it, I can probably figure out where he's from by the color of his eyes, which are lavender, the only remarkable thing about him, as far as I can tell. Really? I say, straightening. What happens when you try? They die?
No, they just don't bloom, he says. It's as if they know where they are, and they save all their beauty for Thuva.
I smile. That's romantic thought.
too romantic for an old man like me, I know.
His eyes sparkle a little.
You must be a Thuvazit, to look so fondly at these plants.
I am, I say. My name is C.Z. Kariseth. I offer him my hand. His own is dry as an old bone.
I'm not permitted to tell you my name, as it would hint at my origins, he says, but I am the assembly leader, Miss Kariseth, and it is lovely to meet you.
My hand goes limp in his. The assembly leader? I am not used to thinking of the person with that title as a real person, with a creaky voice and a wry smile. When they are selected from a pool of candidates by the representatives of all the planets, they are stripped of name and origin, so as not to show any bias. They serve the solar system in its entirety, it said. I'm sorry I didn't recognize you, I say. Something about the man makes me think he will like a subtle manifestation of my current gift, the touch of a warm breeze. He smiles at me, and I think it must have worked on him, since he doesn't look like a man given to smiling.
I am not offended, he says. So you are the daughter of an oracle, then?
I nod. The sitting oracle of Thuva, yes.
And the sister of an oracle, too, if Ijah Kariseth still lives,
he says.
Yes, I've memorized all the oracle names, though I confess I had to use a few memory techniques. It's quite a long mnemonic device. I would share it with you if it didn't have a few vulgarities thrown in to keep it interesting.
I laugh.
You have come here with Issei Benezit? He says. Captain Morrill told me she had brought two friends with her on this visit.
Yes, I was close with her sister, Ori, I say. Orieva, I mean. He makes a soft, sad sound, lips closed.
I am deeply sorry for your loss, then.
Thank you, I say. For now, I can push the grief aside. It's not something this man would be comfortable seeing, so it wouldn't show even if I wanted it to, thanks to my gift.
You must be very angry, he says. The Shotet have taken your father, your brothers, and now your friend.
It's a strange thing to say. It assumes too much. It's not the Shotet who did it, I say. It was Rizek Noavak.
True.
He focuses on the frosty windows again.
But I can't help but think that a people who allow themselves to be ruled by a tyrant, such as Rizek Noavak, deserves to shoulder some of the blame for his behavior.
I want to disagree with him. Supporters of the Noaveks, sure, I can blame them. But the renegades, the exiles, the poor and sick and desperate people living in the neighborhood around that building we used as a safe house? They're just as victimized by Rizek as I am. After visiting the country, I'm not sure I can even think of the Shotet as one thing anymore. They're too varied to be lumped together. It would be like saying that the daughter of a Hessen farmer and a soft-handed Shissa doctor are the same. I want to disagree, but I can't. My tongue is stuck. My throat swollen with my stupid current gift. So I just look passively at the assembly leader and wait for him to talk again.
I am meeting with Miss Benezit later today, he says at last. I hope that you will attend. She is a bit thorny at times, and I sense your presence would soothe her.
That's one of the things I like about her, I say, that she's thorny.
I am sure in friendship it is an entertaining quality, he smiles, but in political discussions it is often an impediment to progress.
I give in to the instinct to step back from him. That depends on how you define progress, I suppose, I say, keeping my tone light.
I hope that we will agree on a definition by the day's end, he says. I will leave you to look at the plants